In the movie Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker fly into Mos Eisley spaceport with R2-D2 and C-3PO in tow. Upon arrival, they run into some stormtroopers looking for their droid companions. To get out of this pickle, Obi-Wan makes use of a Jedi mind trick.
Let me see your identification.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
In recent years, "these aren't the droids you're looking for" has become a popular internet meme. According to knowyourmeme.com, it's a catchphrase often used to humorously assert that an object or statement is not representing what it appears to represent. For example, Urban Dictionary uses the example of Jim saying, "Dude, that hot chick walking over here is checking me out hard," and Steve responding, "These aren't the droids you're looking for. That's my girlfriend, dude." The meme has even found its way into the courtrooms. In People vs. Cooper, the defense tried to claim that Edward Cooper wasn't the one driving a motorcycle that was being driven recklessly, despite strong evidence to the contrary. In closing, the prosecutor argued, "The defense in this case is, and I'm loath to use movie references, I'm hoping at least some of you understand this one, it's pretty good, is the Jedi mind trick. That is the defense. These aren't the droids you're looking for. This is the evidence. That is the argument. This isn't the driver." In rejecting Cooper's ensuing appeal, the court held that while perhaps overly flippant, we do not find this to be an egregious denigration of the defense in this case. In fact, the instant case did boil down to the prosecutor insisting that defendant was the driver of the motorcycle, while defendant asserted he was not the driver of the motorcycle. It's easy to imagine the prosecutor making a similar argument in the Chester Holman case. After all, Deirdre Jones and he were arrested in a white Chevy Blazer with a license plate that started with the letters YZA shortly after an eyewitness had seen the assailant enter a similar vehicle soon after the shooting of Tae-Jung Ho. But over the course of this investigation, we've uncovered evidence that led us to believe, against seemingly all odds, that these weren't the droids the police were looking for.
In last week's episode, we covered the decades of appeals, motions, and petitions filed by Chester and his team, all of which came to naught. When the two star witnesses in the case, Deirdre Jones and Andre Dawkins, recanted their statements, Chester surely thought, this is it, this has to be it. And yet, even that failed. A judge found Jones' recantation to not be credible. In other words, she thought she was lying.
The hard part in these issues, the hard part in these cases, is to convince a judge that the witness is testifying truthfully now. And in our case, the judge just simply rendered a decision that she didn't believe Deirdre's testimony now and dismissed the appeal. It's technically known as a petition, a post-conviction relief act petition, but in effect, it's an appeal. So she dismissed that, and that decision, the credibility determination, whether or not the witness is being honest or not, is not something that the courts of appeal on review and the higher courts will disturb. I mean, they almost by law have to accept the decision, the trial court's decision as to whether the witness is being honest or not.
So when it comes to the recantation of Deirdre Jones, the issue is effectively dead in the courts. You might recall Chester had filed a number of earlier PCRAs before Deirdre, including one based on the Dawkins recantation, and that was denied too. So both of these major pieces of new evidence got him nowhere. Now, would it be possible for him to raise a new PCRA? Only if he found more new evidence that could have changed the outcome of his trial. New evidence of police misconduct, a Brady violation, his innocence, or perhaps someone else's guilt. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Chester Holman III. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I blog at the Youth Parallel too, and I also podcast with Rabia at the 45th.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
We Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over a million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell to help protect their homes. I'm one of those people, and I can say that that Ring doorbell is terrific. It has great audio quality, it has great video quality, and it's given me a level of security in my home that I didn't have before. But Ring knows that home security begins at the front door, but doesn't end there. So now they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, the Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects right to your phone with HD video and two-way audio that lets you know the moment anyone steps in your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home from anywhere. Ring Floodlight offers the ultimate in home security with high visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. With Ring, you're always home. And now, undisclosed listeners, you can save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/undisclosed. That's ring.com/undisclosed. ring.com/undisclosed.
While a court of law may not have believed Deirdre Jones, let's be real. Both Jones and Detective Baker cannot be telling the truth. One of them is lying. And there's also Dawkins, who says that he too was threatened, coerced, promised leniency, if he'd give the statement he gave. And not just by the police, but also by the prosecutor, who was a legend in his time, Roger King. King died a couple years back in 2016, after a 30-year career as a strongman prosecutor in Philadelphia. In an article written after his death, the Philadelphia Inquirer called him larger than life, noting his towering figure both literally and metaphorically, as Philly's top homicide prosecutor.
Roger King, who is the one who prosecuted Chester, he was notorious for doing this. He actually walked around with three bodyguards. He walked around with a gun.
He was respected and feared, and not for nothing. He had retired having broken the record for the most death penalty convictions ever in the state. 16 of them, a whopping 20% of all death sentences imposed in Pennsylvania during his time. He had earned his reputation as the Babe Ruth of prosecutors. But at least seven of those men that he got death penalty convictions for may have been innocent. And in numerous cases, allegations have arisen that King knew, or at least withheld evidence, that pointed to their innocence. In 1994, a defendant named William Neves was successfully prosecuted for murder by King and ended up in death row. In 2000, he was exonerated when it was shown that a witness statement exculpating him was withheld from the defense by King. It took him a long time to secure his freedom, but while in prison, Neves had ended up contracting hepatitis, and in 2005, he died from liver failure, just 5 years after winning his freedom.
James Dennis, another man prosecuted for murder by King, was given a new trial in 2006 when he was able to show that King had not just withheld evidence of an alibi, but also evidence that pointed to the real killer. A third man, Frederick Thomas, prosecuted and sent to death row by King in 1993, was granted a new trial in 2002 when two eyewitnesses recanted their testimony and a lead officer in the case, who the defense said framed Thomas, was convicted on corruption charges arising out of his conduct in other cases, which included falsifying police reports and making false arrests. A similarity between these three cases, other than Roger King being the prosecutor, was that they were all convicted on shaky eyewitness testimony and without any forensic evidence, just like in Chester Holman's case. One of the most famously egregious incidents of misconduct by King was his prosecution of four men in what is known as the Lex Street Massacre, when 10 people were shot in a Philadelphia crack house in December 2000. Seven of them died. It was the worst mass murder the city had ever seen. Charges were quickly brought against a group of four men who maintained their innocence. There was no physical evidence linking them to the crime, and King allegedly coerced one defendant to give a false confession. And though King apparently had information pointing to four other suspects, he refused to release the group he had brought charges on initially. They sat in prison for 19 months before being released and all charges dropped. The men went on to sue the city for the wrongful imprisonment and won $1.9 million.
So yeah, these are just a few of the cases in which defendants have been able to prove misconduct by King. So I can only imagine how many more there are in which a defendant can't prove it. And these are only some of the death row cases. There are many hundreds more that King prosecuted that were not death penalty cases. Given the track record of King and the officers in Chester's case, if I have to believe either the witnesses or the officials, Deirdre or Detective Baker, well, my bets are on those who had nothing to gain and plenty to lose by coming forward all these years later. It can be hard to judge sometimes if the police or prosecutors act in ethically questionable ways out of corruption, bad faith, or with a sincere belief they have the right person, and because they're dealing with bad actors, they also have to act a little bad just to get their conviction. From the very beginning, I found it understandable that Chester and Deirdre were the prime suspects. The cops were looking for four young black people in a white Chevy Blazer with tags starting with the letters YZA. And minutes after the crime, and not too far away, along come Chester and Deirdre, two young black people in a white Chevy Blazer with the tag starting with YZA. So yeah, it's totally understandable. But what the police were about to learn soon after would make it harder to understand why they charged Chester in the crime. The car that Chester was driving, as we mentioned earlier in the series, didn't belong to him. It was his roommate's, who was away for a few days and told him he could drive it. But it also didn't belong to his roommate, Sean Boyce. It belonged to Alamo Rental Car. And the police knew that immediately because records show they went to interview Patricia Laws, an Alamo administrative clerk, the morning after the murder around 10:30 a.m. We'll get back to that interview in a bit, but first let's back up to see exactly what was happening at this Alamo because there was a lot of shady stuff going on.
Apparently, it was not uncommon for people to rent vehicles continuously. Renting one out, bringing it back in, and then checking another one out at the same time. Or renting multiple cars at the same time. A unusual thing to do for a lot of people, but they'd rent them using names and credit cards of other people to get the car out and then pay cash upon return, if the car was returned, because sometimes the cars weren't. In his initial police statement, Chester told the cops that the car was his roommate's, who was dating a girl who worked at the Alamo, and he thought that maybe the Blazer was stolen inventory. He was referring to cars that got rented, never returned, and then written off as losses. This is not a new con. It is not one that's gone away in the years since Chester's conviction. In 2016, the Philly Police Department busted a massive auto theft ring that operated an elaborate scheme. Two men had set up a company that only existed on paper, called Cheap Auto, which bought cars from online auctions. They and their co-conspirators would strip the cars of their VIN numbers and transfer them to stolen cars, doctor registrations, fake inspections, and then sell them. The unsuspecting buyers had no idea that they were purchasing cars that had been stolen from half a dozen different rental companies, including Alamo. And it was a huge bust. In all, 32 people were charged in connection with the scam. And none of them, from the publicly available records, seem to have been employees of the rental companies themselves. But back in 1991, it seems pretty clear that some of the Alamo employees were in on all aspects of the scam. The same day as the murder, the police go to the Alamo, and they talk to a woman named Patricia Laws. However, the interview doesn't really turn up anything about, you know, this car rental scam shadiness, or really anything much at all. They don't learn much, and in fact, they don't even ask her about Chester or the white Chevy Blazer. Instead, she's asked if she ever rented a Cadillac Seville to a man named Joseph McHugh on the day before the murder. She said yeah, and said he was a white man. Then they asked her if he'd come into the rental shop with anyone else, and she said she didn't think so. And that was the extent of it. That was the end of the interview. Not a single question that seems relevant to the actual crime. We still don't know what to make of it or who the heck Joseph McHugh is. The next time police interviewed an Alamo employee was not until August 30th, 1991, 10 days later.
Sharon Wilderson, the woman Chester thought his roommate Sean Boyce was dating, was grilled pretty well by the detectives. And in that interview, Sharon admitted that as an Alamo employee, she would rent out cars to people that she knew were presenting credentials that weren't their own. If she could enter a name, driver's license, and credit card number given to her, she didn't always care if they matched up to the person standing at the counter, the one who would actually drive away with the car. Her reasoning seems to be that they would pay with cash upon return anyway, so these were just formalities. Also, she openly admitted in her statement that she would get some pocket cash for looking the other way. Sharon was asked if she knew Sean, if she had seen him around Alamo, if she had rented to him. She said yes, she knew him, had even gotten rides from him, but she wasn't dating him. And yes, he came in there multiple times to rent cars, often with someone else. often with some third party's credentials to do it. And he and the other men he had come with had given her cash a couple times, presumably to keep quiet about how they were renting the cars. Sharon was shown a receipt for a Chevy Blazer that was rented on August 14, 1991, about a week before the murder. It was rented to someone by the name of John Cormack. She said she didn't recall, even though the document showed she was the one who had rented the vehicle out. A bit later, she's asked if she remembers renting a Blazer out to Sean, and she did, in mid-August. He had come in with a friend who provided his driver's license, she said, and signed for the car. Now, what she may be forgetting as she spoke to the police, or what she was pretending to forget, was that the friend that signed the Blazer out had the name of John Cormack. The problem here is that John Cormack, whose license number and credit card were used to rent the Blazer, was an executive at Comcast Cable. More precisely, as the Alamo note mentions, a white executive who had nothing to do with the rental and told the police his credit card had not been stolen. Now remember, the cards would be used to take the vehicles out, but not used to pay for them. Sharon also remembered Sean coming in about a month or two prior to the murder in June or July to rent out a Cadillac Seville a few times. The day that Sean let Chester borrow the Blazer, he also had a Seville rented out at the same time. It seems like he liked to have a caddy to drive fairly frequently. Sharon recalled a few times that Sean came in to get the caddy and the Blazer. There was another man with him. They were always different men, she said, but all in their 20s, around 5'5 or 5'6, medium builds, but she wasn't sure if she could recognize them if she saw them. Earlier in the interview, she was shown a photograph of Chester Holman, and she said no. She didn't know him, had never seen him before.
On the night of the murder, Chester was driving the Chevy Blazer given to him by Sean Boyce, rented out in the name of the Comcast executive John Cormack. But it wasn't the only white Chevy Blazer that Alamo owned. They actually had four in total. And three of those four were definitely rented out when Taejung Ho was killed. And here is the kicker.
As we researched Alamo car rental, we realized that they had three Chevy Blazers that were rented that night, okay? All bearing the same three letters on the tag, YZA. That was like, I guess, their fleet. They used, you know, all the licenses had that number on it.
Yes, you heard right. All the Alamo-owned white Chevy Blazers had tags starting with the letters YZA. That, by the way, was private investigator Dennis Crossan, who has been the lead defense investigator on the case, working with the Holmans for years. And he's the one who got the recantations from Dawkins and Jones. Now remember, those are the only parts of the tag on the getaway vehicle that the cab driver, Henderson, saw and noted that night. He never mentioned, because it seems like he never quite caught it, the rest of the tag number. And if he had, Chester likely wouldn't be in prison today. So that means we've got three other possible vehicles that could have been the getaway car that night, so let's go through them. But the first one we can kind of eliminate. It was a Blazer with the tags YZA813. It was, according to the Alamo records, rented out on August 20th, the day of the murder. But remember, the murder took place around 1 a.m. It was on the 20th, but the day was just beginning. This car wasn't rented out until 4 p.m. that day, about 15 hours after the murder. So unless we're missing documents to show this Blazer had been out the night before, returned, cleaned, and then rented again in that 15-hour period, it's probably not the car in question. But we can't say that for sure, because we only know this car existed thanks to the trial testimony of an Alamo employee, Jay Barsky. I can't find any documentation in the records that we have about this car otherwise. Not when it was last rented, not who rented it out on that day, not when it was returned. Nothing more than, well, it doesn't look like it was on the road at the time of the murder. So moving on to the three cars that were on the road when Taejung was killed. There was the one that Chester was driving, which then leaves two. And one of them, oddly enough, was actually being driven by Sharon Wilderson, the Alamo employee herself. According to a police interview, Sharon had in her possession a white Chevy Blazer with the tags YZA805. The car wasn't rented out in her name, though. Here's what she had to say.
I had a white Blazer from Alamo that Keith Williams, a friend of a guy I know as Carl, Keith rented the Blazer for me because my rental time as an employee for the company had run out. Carl told me that he would rent the Blazer out for me if I drove an out-of-town guest of his to Reading, and then I could keep the car. But then Carl came in that evening and told me he would take his guest to Reading so I could keep the Blazer. That was a week before I was to go on vacation.
Sharon goes on to say that on the evening of the 19th, she left Philadelphia and drove to Landover, Maryland. From there, the next day she went to her sister's in Washington, D.C., and on Wednesday the 21st, she flew to Jamaica. She returned the next week on August 27th. The blazer that she had, according to the trial testimony again of Mr. Barsky, was returned the following day on August 28th. But also, according to his testimony, it had been rented out the night before the murder on the 19th. But if you recall from just a minute ago, Sharon said that she had gotten the car a week before she went on the vacation, so something there doesn't add up. Unfortunately, we don't have the rental records for that car to know exactly when it was taken out. We also can't be sure who rented it because Keith Williams could very well be another fake ID used to rent it. No one looked into who Carl is, so this lead kind of peters out here. Whether she got the car the week before or the night before the murder, the point is that that car was on the road. No one knows exactly where it was that night because as far as we know, no investigator looked into it at the time, and she never testified at trial.
The police don't seem to be at all suspicious either of her story and what she was doing with the blazer, which is kind of odd given her relationship with Sean Boyce, who they did seem highly suspicious of. They had grilled Sharon pretty intensely about Sean, about his rental habits, about the people he came in with, about the kind of stuff he was involved in. Sharon told them she wasn't sure, but she thought he was a drug runner and that he told her he was going to sell one of the rented cars out one day. She even said she was afraid of Sean, that she'd heard him threaten others with violence. So is it possible that Sean Boyce and Sharon were together on the night of the murder, and that he was in her blazer? Boyce has a rap sheet that's 22 inches long and includes drug and assault charges. And Chester didn't have much nice to say about him either. They hadn't been living together long, and he didn't even know him very well. But it was a way to save on rent, even though it ended up costing him in other ways.
Chester wrote to me, and this all relates to what we were just talking about. He wrote to me and said that he had recently moved in with this guy, Sean Bryce. Mm-hmm. And he said about 2 weeks before this incident happened, and I don't think he even reported this to anybody, he went away for a couple of days, and he had left his service revolver, which I believe was a .38 caliber, in his closet or somewhere, along with $400. And when he came back, the gun was gone and $400 was gone.
That's Dennis Cresson again, talking about an incident Chester told him about just a couple of years ago. Chester can't be sure if Boyce stole his money and gun because there had been other people over at the apartment, but it's entirely possible that Boyce did. It would line up with some of the other things Chester had told Cresson over the years. That Sean never paid the rent he owed, he was a freeloader, and that he was likely involved in drug running. Then there was a girl named Sonia that Sean began dating, but over time, she became closer to Chester. Sean had developed some jealousy and joked with Chester that he had stolen his girl, though it wasn't true. And shortly after Chester was arrested, the same girl, Sonia Bishop, came to visit Chester in prison. She also brought a friend along.
In summer of 2016, Chester wrote to me, and we started talking about this, these two girls that came to visit him. Now, he had spoke about this before, but, you know, I was dealing more with the immediate kind of things, mm-hmm. and this was kind of like one. So I had the name of this girl, Sonia Bishop, was one of the girls that came to visit him. And he said they were very probative and asking a lot of questions, and it kind of sounded like they made him uncomfortable, and they kind of like wanted to know what. So in the summer, I find this girl, Sonia Bishop, and I call her up. I go to her house, and her son's living at the house, but she's living somewhere else. But I get in touch with her, and I actually had three meetings with her. Now, everything went very nice. You know, I'm like buying her dinner or something, you know, and so we're sitting and having confidence. So I'm asking her, you know, what she was dating, she was dating Chester. So I'm asking her, you know, what kind of person was he? What was he going to? And she wasn't. So I didn't say too much about this visit that she made, but I met with her three times, and everything was very pleasant the first two times. Mm-hmm. So I started pushing her as to, she went with her girlfriend to visit him in wherever they were holding him before trial, probably when he was first arrested. It might have been the House of Correction or one of these prisons that's closed up now. And so the girlfriend, I find out that she went with her, is a girl named Anita. I never met with her, and I don't know her last name, but she was dating Sean Bryce's brother. And Sonny Bishop was dating Chester. At any rate, we start talking, and she gets me, she said, well, this girl Anita has a picture of Sean Bryce on Facebook, which I have a copy of here. I said, great. I said, would you get me a copy? So it took a couple times to, you know, to get this girl to finally send me the copy. So when I started getting a little more probative as to why they were there asking him so many questions and whatever, she kind of got like real defensive. And actually, I showed her a letter, which I couldn't find, but I know it's in my mess somewhere, that Chester had written and is, you know, asking about this girl. Well, you know, why was she there? Why was she asking? And the questions they were asking was, did he think that Sean Bryce was involved in this?
This visit made Chester pretty uncomfortable and set up some red flags for Crisan too. Why did these girls think Sean was involved, and why were they grilling Chester for information? One possible explanation here is that Sean had sent them to find out just what Chester knew. Another possibility is that they were just two young curious girls who wanted to get the 411. So if Sean Boyce had been able to hook up with the Chevy Blazer the night of the murder, he could also be a strong suspect. After all, Tae Jung Ho was killed with a bullet from a .38, the very same kind of gun that was stolen from Chester's own closet.
This takes us to the last Chevy Blazer out in the road that night that had tags starting with the letters YZA. Its full tag was YZA789, and it was rented out by a young woman named Denise Combs.
One was rented to a girl, Denise Combs. So we did some background check on her and saw that what I found out about her was that she was arrested for assaulting an assistant district attorney in City Hall. Mm-hmm. So I started looking into, what was she trial in City Hall on the 600 level, which is where the murder cases are tried back then.
So what was Denise doing at a murder trial? It turns out her brother, Jack Combs, was on trial for murder. On April 18th, 1990, Denise ended up assaulting an assistant DA when at the courthouse to attend a hearing on the murder charges her brother was facing. Of course, the fact that Denise Combs had one of the white Chevy Blazers the night of the murder, and that her brother was facing murder charges, not one but two murders in the same time period, more than piqued our interest. And it seems it slightly piqued the interest of detectives back in 1991 as they were investigating the case. The documents we have don't tell the entire story, but on September 10th, 1991, about a month after the murder, the police apparently retrieved rental records from Alamo reflecting all the different Blazer rentals for August 20th. Denise Combs' name came up showing she had a Blazer rented, not only for that night, but had rented a Blazer on May 20th for 35 days, then on June 28th for 10 days, and then on July 14th for another 38 days. That last rental, the one she had in the night of the murder, she returns to the Alamo lot on August 21st at 4:59 a.m., a little over 24 hours after Tae Jung Ho was killed. So anyway, the police pull these records on September 10th, find out there's a woman named Denise Combs with a Blazer and a criminal record, and less than 2 days later, on September 12th, detectives pick up Andre Dawkins and bring him to the station at 2 a.m. He's there until 7:30 a.m., for over 5 hours, and in that time he's shown a photo array of young black women and asked if he recognizes anyone. He says one of them looks like the woman who could have been the driver of the Blazer, and the photo he selects is none other than Denise Combs.
Remember, the cops already have Deirdre Jones pegged as the woman in the passenger seat, and she confessed too, but they still need a driver. And Denise Combs would seem to fit the bill. She has the long dark hair that a number of witnesses described in her mugshot from the previous year, and certainly there could have been a bleach streak through it in 1991. The problem is that there's no documentation to show the police did anything further to investigate Denise Combs. It's just as strange that if all they wanted Andre Dawkins to do was take a look at a photo array, why did they keep him at the station for over 5 hours that night? Well, it might have something to do with the fact that the preliminary hearing was the same day. Dawkins was released at 7:30 a.m., and he had to be court not long after. And while he may have just potentially identified the driver of the getaway vehicle, it's never mentioned at the hearing. It could be that they kept him at the police station all that time to make sure he didn't mention it. While his identification of Denise Combs was divulged to the defense in discovery, something else related to Combs wasn't. In 2011, Alan Tauber, Chester's attorney, and Pennsylvania Innocence Project investigator, Shina Tyler, gave Denise Combs a visit to ask her about that blazer because it didn't look like anyone else had ever done so before the trial. The report written after the visit stated the following.
Combs stated she recalled a detective coming to her house one day, inquiring about the vehicle she had rented, a white Bronco. The detective looked at her license plate and told her that it did not match the plate he was looking for. He also told her that she did not fit the description of the suspect he was looking for. Combs did not sign any statements. Combs did not go to the police station and give a formal statement. Combs was not contacted by the detective again. Combs did not testify at trial.
Just to reiterate, there are no records in our possession and in the possession of Chester's defense team indicating any police ever visited Denise Combs about this case. Could she be misremembering or making it up? I mean, it's possible, but I don't see any reason for her to insert herself into the case for no reason. And I see every reason for the police to have gone to check her out. We don't have a date for this visit, but if a cop was visiting her to check the plates on a white truck she had rented, albeit a Blazer and not a Bronco, it seems likely it would have been soon after pulling the rental records from Alamo. But was it before or after Dawkins identified her from the photo array? Did she still have the car on her when the cop came, or was it a different rental? There's just no way to know from what we have.
So when Tauber visited her in 2011, she apparently spent a bit of time discussing her brother's case with him. Jack Combs had been fighting his convictions, two convictions for two murders, and he'd maintained his innocence and his family believed him. Getting into those cases would be, well, an entirely new series, but suffice it to say that he could not have been one of the men who attacked Taejung because he was in prison the night of the murder. But that doesn't let Denise off the hook. She ran with a bit of a dangerous crowd and had a habit of renting multiple cars at the same time and giving them to others to use. In fact, in 1990, her brother had been driving a car Denise had rented during the commission of one of the murders he was ultimately convicted of. And Alamo records show a car she rented in September of 1991 had ended up impounded by the cops after a man driving it was arrested. While we don't have a record of the man's name, the Alamo report says that he told the police that Denise Combs had given him the car. Two instances don't make a pattern necessarily, but it does certainly suggest a strong possibility that there could have been a third instance in which a car rented by Denise was used in a crime. The question then is, who were the two men in the blazer that night? The ones that actually attacked Taejung. We know Denise dated an extremely dangerous man at one point. She told that to Tauber when he visited her. Her ex-boyfriend, Danielle Patty, Denise told him, would kill anyone. Women, children, witnesses, friends, anyone in his way, he would shoot and kill. And even though he was in prison in 2011 when she told Tauber this, she was still terrified of him because she said he had the power to have people killed from inside prison. Denise called him a serial killer, saying he had over 100 murders to his name, and that he'd tried to have her son's father killed four times.
Having looked at Patty's records, I can confirm that he seems highly dangerous, though 100 murders aren't exactly reflected in it. And he certainly could have been one of the men in the blazer that night, except that, just like Denise's brother Jack, Patty was in prison, awaiting trial on a double homicide the night that Taejung was killed.
So yeah, that probably rules him out. And as we consider who could have been with Denise that night, if she was in fact driving the getaway car, it just so happens that she had an additional driver listed on her blazer rental. It was a man by the name of Jeffrey Green. Although it's important to note that her brother Jack also sometimes used the name Jeffrey Green as an alias. Green was a real person though, and he happened to be their cousin. And he was someone with a criminal history, including robberies back in the 90s. Then there was a name that popped up a few times in connection with Jack Combs, a man named Kenneth Singer. Singer has a record that spans nearly two decades, mostly for theft, once even being arrested with Jack back in 1988. Singer, we recently learned, is also the father of Denise's child, the one that Patty allegedly tried to kill four times. He's clearly close to the Combs family, and it just so happens that he was not in prison the night Taejung was killed. He doesn't have any violent crimes in his record, but could he have been the second man, the one who held down Taejung's legs and searched his pockets? Maybe? I mean, who knows, because there are a lot of shady characters connected to Denise back in the early 90s. And if she was the driver, it could be anyone's guess who the others in the car might have been.
So we decided to see if we could find her again after all these years to get more information out of Denise. I went in search of Denise with Celeste Trusty, who you heard from in the first episode of the series and who has been helping to investigate the case with me. We didn't know if this would work out and if she would talk to us because, after all, we were there because we thought she could be a suspect in a murder. But we also knew this, that her only sibling, Jack, had maintained his innocence all these years, and she had spoken about him with Alan Tauber back in 2011, so we thought, well, what better way to get our foot in the door?
Wow, where are y'all from?
So I actually do wrongful conviction investigations on my own. I have a blog called The Jury Room. But anyway, I look into wrongful convictions out of Philadelphia, and I know that Jack has two innocence claims.
Right.
So I wanted to talk to you guys about the cases, see if there's anything that we can do to try to help.
Okay.
See if there's, you know, anything.
Come on, a couple of cheers.
Okay, so we weren't telling the entire truth of why we were there, but we weren't lying either. I actually think Jack has a strong innocence claim on one of the murders he's in for. The second one, not so sure, but we were certainly curious about his cases and open to discussing them, with the hopes we could discuss Chester's case as well. Denise wasn't home alone. Her mom was there as well. And both of them were very eager to talk about Jack's cases. It was clear and heartbreaking that they both believed he was completely innocent, and it had taken a devastating toll on them.
I used to cry. I was like, very depressed for like 10 years. I did everything I could do for him. For 10 years, depression, and I'm like, I used to go on the radio. We put on a march. I mean, I would not try. I'd be like, who's this girl fighting hard to get her brother home?
I couldn't help but think about Deanna Holman, Chester's only sibling as well, and how both of these sisters, Denise and Deanna, had been fighting the same fight for their brothers. And it also didn't escape me that one of these women may be responsible for the pain of the other. We spent most of our time talking about Jack's two murder cases, but eventually Celeste was able to pivot the conversation to Chester's case.
So I know your name has come up in another case that I'm looking at, of course.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, now that it's like, it's going to maybe help me a little bit because I know.
Money?
So not
Rabbit
you as a
suspect.
No, I'm sorry. So another car that you rented came up in a murder.
I had police come to my house.
Yeah.
When?
Do you know?
I'll say 91. They came to my house about a homicide.
Right.
And they checked my vehicle. They put the license plate down. They said somebody had my license plate that was in a homicide.
Okay.
And they took it, and that was it.
Do you know what cop that was?
I had no idea. Not back then. I had no idea. Because it wasn't, like, important to me.
Right, right.
You know,
and that was the end of it.
That was pretty much it. She didn't want to say anything more about that incident because, as far as she was concerned, it had nothing to do with her. I, however, left her home that night, unable to shake the feeling that the Blazer used as the getaway vehicle in Taejung's murder might have been hers and that she might have been the driver. The information she offered voluntarily a couple weeks later only confirmed my suspicion. Denise and Celeste stayed in touch, and not long after our visit, they met up again, and this time with Zachary Stern from the Innocence Project joining them. As soon as they left the meeting, Celeste called me with some urgent news.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's going on?
I'm with Zach, and we got to talk to Denise again.
Oh, okay.
And we wanted to tell you something she said, and I think Zach wanted to hear your initial reaction also.
I'm not a creep, though, Rob.
No, it's just, so we went in and talked to her, and...
In person?
She was just in person.
Okay.
And she said Jeffrey Green and her were very, very close, blah, 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 but which is great. But she said that she used to have a .38.
What?
And, uh-huh. And they grew up around guns. They always had guns. And in 1992, homicide came to her house while her dad was there. And they took them all down. They locked them all up overnight, whatever. And she told us that before that, she had thrown out the two guns she had, which is a .38 and a what, .357, because they might have a body on them.
What?
Direct quote.
Direct quote.
What?
Direct quote. She said that, like, you know, with her friends, like, they would just give each other guns. You know, she'd pass guns along, blah, blah, blah. But she did have guns. She loved guns. And before 1992, so between, you know, right around that time, she had a .38 and a .357 that she threw in the trash can before 1992 because they might have a body on them.
So if the Blazer that was driven by the getaway driver isn't connected to Chester Holman, that leaves us with two strong possibilities. The getaway car might have been the Blazer that Sharon Wilderson had access to that night, or the Blazer that Denise Combs had that night. Both of these women either had access to a .38 or had access to someone who did. Both women were connected to men with criminal records, and we have no accounting of what either woman was doing that night at the time of the murder. If only the police had followed up on investigating either of them, they might have found that these women were connected or weren't connected. But there was little incentive to do so when they had already made their arrests and gotten confessions immediately. What were they supposed to do? Drop the charges, admit the confessions were false? In any event, none of what we've learned about Denise Combs, I'm fairly confident, is enough evidence to get Chester one more shot at a PCRA petition. But he has another shot elsewhere, outside of the courts, with the Philadelphia Conviction Integrity Unit. Last week, Chester's attorney filed an application with the unit, which has now been kicked into overdrive with Larry Krasner's appointment of Patricia Cummings as the new head of the unit. Cummings, a former defense attorney, comes to the job from the Dallas County DA's Conviction Integrity Unit and is nationally known for her work on behalf of the wrongfully convicted. Chester's filing is 8 pages long and requests that the CIU open a full investigation and review of Chester's conviction, citing the witness recantations, Denise Combs' probability as a suspect, and Chester's never wavering from his claim of innocence. That claim is so strong that when Chester was offered a plea deal to drastically reduce his sentence if he provided the name of the shooter, he refused it. He didn't know who the shooter was because he wasn't involved. His attorney at the time suggested he offer up any name, but Chester said no, and that lawyer withdrew from the case.
Years later, long after Chester was convicted, the prosecutor originally signed to the case, Hugh Heelhan, visited Chester in prison along with one of the detectives from the case, Detective Witcher. He made Chester an offer. If he offered up the name of the shooter, he'd recommend clemency for him in a petition to the governor. Chester, who was serving a life sentence then and now, again declined. He couldn't give him the name of the shooter because he had no idea who the shooter was. All of this and more are included in Chester's application to the CIU. It's one of his last best shots. I say one of because there's still another possibility, and that's this, that his homicide file is finally turned over. Because if that's the case, that could potentially reveal Brady material. There are many things missing from the documents that Chester's defense team has because, as we explained in Sean Thomas's case last summer, a defendant doesn't have a right to the homicide file in Pennsylvania. When it comes to discovery, Pennsylvania is a ridiculously restrictive state, and this rule, which remains in effect even after a defendant's conviction, hogties defendants in the appellate process. It also, by the way, hogties the truth. If it's truly the mission and charge of the state, the police, and the prosecution to seek the truth in order to serve justice, there's no reason not to release homicide files. Other states do so, with none of the consequences that Pennsylvania says it fears will happen. It does seem like the real reason, or at least a very strong motivator they have here, is that handing over the files would do something harmful to the state's case. And that shouldn't be a reason at all. We know that there's a good chance that somewhere in those files, there's material that would undermine the state's case and help Chester. For instance, the missing report from when the cops visited Denise Combs, that's certainly something I'd like to see. And then there's this. When Celeste visited Dennis Crossan, she got a copy of his file and noticed a glaring difference between the copy of Chester's police statement that was in his file for all these years and the one that she had, which was labeled Pyrie's copy. The Crossan copy is the original. It's the one the defense counsel had all along, and it's handwritten the entire way down. Starting on the bottom of the second to last page is a near paragraph written by Detective Pyrie. Yeah, and that's the same detective who punched Chester in the mouth. It says,
I want you to know there are witnesses outside being interviewed and have identified you and another male. You and another male who robbed and shot and killed an Oriental College student at 1 a.m. today at 21st and Walnut Street. They also got your license plate number and identified you fleeing the robbery and body and you jumping into the rear open window. And identified you and Deirdre in the vehicle several minutes after the shooting. Immediately after that is the portion in the interview record where Chester allegedly says, yes, I don't want to say anymore. I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut, shit. Which is kind of a weird response to the paragraph before it. And finally, the next question says, how are you treated by the police detectives? And the answer is, decently.
But the copy Celeste had, the one labeled Pyrie's copy, it came from the courthouse as a part of the trial exhibits. It's not the same version the defense has. The large paragraph about witnesses seeing Chester in the original is erased. Instead, there's a typewritten bit that seems to be pasted over the top that reads,
"At this time, I showed Chester Holman 3 pages of a statement by Deirdre Jones. He read the 3 pages and then stated, and in closed parentheses, go to the next page. Now, the next page has that answer where Chester said, 'I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut. Shit.' And on the next page, in Pyrie's copy, there's no question and answer about how the detectives treated him."
Pyrie was actually asked on the stand at the trial whether he showed Chester Deirdre's statements, and he was very vehement in saying no, he hadn't. But what to make of the copy that spells out that, yeah, he did? For the record, Chester recalls being shown something, some document, and being told it was Deirdre's statement. And it's hard to understand then why Pyrie lied about it, especially after going to the pain of altering the original to reflect exactly that.
We don't know, but the point here is if this document is altered, who knows how many others could be. Getting a hold of the homicide file is vital in this case, and really in any case these detectives and this prosecutor touched. Speaking of which, the new Philly DA, Larry Krasner, has a list of suspect police officers and publicly acknowledged that prosecutors have been internally circulating a secret list of more than 24 officers whose corruption may have tainted their testimony in court. Once he's verified the charges against them, he has vowed to make that list public, which could open the doors to defendants getting a new chance if there was misconduct in their case. And this is all great news for Philadelphia, and these are the changes that the Holmans are hanging their hats on for now. When I began reviewing the files last year, I noticed portions of them highlighted with comments and assumed that these had been made by lawyers or investigators over the years. I was wrong.
So after Chester was convicted, his family made these amazing binders to give out to anybody who would listen about the injustice being done to their son. You know, and I'd already seen most of the documents that the binder contained, but it starts out with a note written by Chester's mom. You know, and as a mother, I cannot even imagine being in the position that Chester's mother was in. But reading the words that she wrote about this injustice and reading the words that, you know, her saying, my son, and it is just something that will stick with me for the rest of my life. And it kind of just adds, you know, something else to this case, because Chester's mother passed away in 1999. She had been very sick. She was on dialysis for many, many, many years. And she passed away just 8 years after Chester was arrested for the murder that he didn't commit. Chester never got to say goodbye to his mother. His mother never got to say goodbye to him. You know, and that's something that, it's just something that they'll never, ever, ever get that back.
If you saw these painstakingly written notations, the tabs, the careful examination of the files, it would break your heart because as sick as she was, Chester's mother fought for him until the very end. And when we sat with Denise Combs and her mother, who was also very elderly and sick, I couldn't help thinking they must be just as full of dread that their son, their brother, Jack Combs, won't make it home to see his mother before she passes as well. The Philadelphia Inquirer story helped breathe new life into this case, but it couldn't have happened without the continued effort of the people who support Chester, including Alan Tauber, the attorney who has been by his side for nearly a decade, the Innocence Project, people like Celeste Trusty, and of course, longtime investigator turned friend, Dennis Crossan.
This summer, we started conducting some rallies.
Okay.
This is like a side story. We conducted a couple of rallies down in Center City across from City Hall, and I just encouraged the family, let's make up some t-shirts and posters, and we're good. Mm-hmm. This is after the article came out.
Okay,
on the paper.
Right.
Because this is right. What I had been pushing for. I had been to the Inquirer many, many times. I said, you got to look at this story. You got to write the story about this family that has been bankrupt through the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. paying for attorneys and paying, just legal fees. He's an old man now. I think when I first met him, he was working 3 jobs and they spent like a ton of money. Through different lawyers, I said the story here is how the criminal justice system has bankrupted these people.
Right.
And they're great people. I mean, they are strong and strong and strong.
Thank you.
We are hoping that the Hallman family continues to stay strong, knowing that there are many more now thinking about Chester, and that the undisclosed team will continue to follow this case and the other Philadelphia cases that we've covered and report on them. Having spent the past 8 months or so reporting on cases out of Philadelphia has been eye-opening and at times enraging, but seeing the changes there gives me hope. It's time now, though, for the undisclosed team to move out of Philly to a new place, a new city, a new state.
My mom said to my brother, and I remember sitting there one time, she said, "A lie can only stand but so long." Now, it's been almost 30 years, but we know that it can only stand but so long.
Next time on Undisclosed. A very big thank you to Chester Hallman III and his family for allowing us to cover his case, for Alan Tauber for working with us, for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project with Zachary Stern, for Celeste Trusty, who has been an amazing advocate for the wrongfully convicted, a wonderful investigator, and a diligent, committed person to this cause. I do want to urge all of our listeners to follow Celeste's work online. You can find her at Twitter. Her handle is at The Jury Room Blog, and you can find her blog at thejuryroom.org, and also you can support her by becoming a patron of her work. If you find her online, you will find the links and see how you can become a patron, and I urge you to do that, as well as also support the work of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. I want to thank, as always, our executive producer, Mithil Thelhan, Baluki for our logo, the amazing Rebecca Lavoie, host and producer of Crime Writers On. A big thank you to all of our sponsors. You can follow us on social media. Our handle is at UndisclosedPod. Don't forget to use the hashtag UDAddendum to tag any questions you want us to answer. Thanks for listening. We look forward to returning with so many more cases for you this year.